This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now, please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, listeners today. I am so excited. I feel like I need this podcast today. I want to learn something new today.
Well, what are we going to learn today? Let's find out.
How do fossils help our cars go?
Fossils? They make our cars go? How does that work? Who's going to talk to us about this, Jeff?
Today we have Maria Nyagam, a chemical engineer, who is going to explain how fossils make our car go.
Oh, this is going to be fun. Welcome to the show, Maria.
Hi, everyone.
We are so excited to have you. So first of all, let's explain to kids, what is a chemical engineer?
A chemical engineer is an engineer that studies basically process engineering. So how do we process something, whether it's making makeup or beer or oil and gas? It's just the process of how do we make something.
So it uses chemistry to do this, right?
So it does, yeah. So separation processes and different types of ways that we can pull things apart and put things together to make different products.
Right off the bat, this reminds me of a biography I once read of George Washington Carver, who long time ago found something like 300 uses for the peanut by pulling it apart and putting it back together.
Wow.
Is that similar to what you do?
Not quite, but the root of it is basically what we do. And my focus over the past 10 years has been in oil and gas, which is kind of a subset of something that you could do as a chemical engineer. And my role was to find where oil and gas was and to kind of simulate how it would flow underground and how we could find it and produce it to the surface.
Oh, cool. So that leads right into the question that we want you to answer is, how do fossils make cars go?
So oil and natural gas are referred to as fossil fuels. And when most people hear fossils, we think of dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs. Yes. Absolutely. We had to say that all together. Dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs. And wouldn't that be so cool if oil and gas was made from dinosaurs? But it's actually not those large land animals that are the source of oil and gas. It's actually our tiniest living organisms that were in the water millions and millions and millions of years ago that left their remains behind that eventually turned into the oil and gas that we know today.
Wow.
So if we can rewind millions and millions and millions of years ago, and dinosaurs are roaming the earth, and the water is really tropical, and there's a lot more ocean than there is now, there was a lot of plankton in the water, a lot of phytoplankton, zooplankton, algae, and bacteria. And when these died, they settled to the bottom of the ocean, and right, they got covered by sediment and mud and dirt. And with lots of time and pressure, it turned into rock, sedimentary rock. And these algae and plankton turned into oil and gas. Oh. So if the temperature was really high, it would turn into oil. But if the temperature was even higher than that, it would turn into gas. So, and because oil and gas is lighter, less dense than the Earth's crust and the water underneath our surface, it actually started to rise. It started to migrate through the holes and pathways in the rocks and move up and up and up until it finally hit a rock that stopped it, a trap that it couldn't get past. And once it hit this trap, whether it was a rock or a structure, it stayed there. And that's what we call a reservoir.
Mm-hmm.
which is a trapping of oil and gas. So as geologists and geophysicists and engineers like myself, we try and find these reservoirs. And they are not everywhere. You can't be like, oh, I'm going to drill under my house and I'm going to find some.
Probably you make not. A lot of money, right? I mean, allegedly, if you have an oil well, you make lots of money.
Allegedly.
Yeah. Okay.
The oil and gas reserves in the world are spread out throughout the earth. They're actually, a lot of the times, they're where we find the most dinosaur bones. So a lot of our biggest reserves are in the Middle East, in Russia, in South America, in Venezuela, up here in Canada, where I am. So once we find these reservoirs, we drill a well. Depending on where the reservoir is, it could be hundreds of feet under the ground, or it could be thousands of feet under the ground. Oh, it wow. could be Whoa. One Empire State Building or three Empire State Buildings under the ground. And so we drill this well, which is really just a long piece of pipe down into the ground, and we cement it into place, and then we have the oil and gas flow up through it. And once it comes to the surface, we gather it, we separate out the gas, the water, and the oil, and then we ship it via pipeline so that it can get turned into gasoline. Gas being short for gasoline, which is sure. the gas that goes into our car.
All right.
Yeah.
So the fossils really do power our cars, and that's how I got to work today.
Yeah.
Okay. So as you were describing how those reservoirs formed and you were listing out where some of the largest ones are, you were listing land masses and countries. Mm-hmm. And my brain went back to earlier when you said it was actually all the plankton and phytoplankton that were in oceans. But the oceans, it reminded me, the oceans weren't always in the same place.
Exactly.
So the continents also weren't always in the same place. We mm-hmm. had Pangaea, that one supercontinent. Mm-hmm. So oceans covered most of the planet.
Absolutely.
This is quite an Earth lesson all the way back to millions
For
and tens
sure.
and hundreds of millions of years.
Definitely. So Alberta, the province that I live in, was actually underwater. And so at that point in time, when the deposits were settling, we were underwater, and then now it's land. And so we got to drill underneath to find right. to find those ancient seas where these organisms were deposited.
So how do you find the oil? I mean, now Great we know question, we Jeff, know some right. areas, right, where that have oil and gas and whatever, but how do you find it?
That is a very good question. And it is the question we're all asking ourselves all the time. So
no magic wand yet.
Yeah.
No magic wand yet, because we obviously we're standing on the surface and we are trying to make guesses actually about what's okay. happening hundreds to thousands of feet underneath us. So there's a couple of tools that we can use to try and make more educated guesses.
Right.
For example, one of them is something we call seismic, which is basically us creating vibrations in the ground and then listening for the sound waves that come back through the ground.
Yeah.
And that gives us a picture of what the ground looks like underneath in just waves. In waves. And so that gives okay. us an idea of what the structure and the thickness of different formations are under the ground. Another thing that we can do is sometimes these formations, based on tectonic activity and different ways that the earth has moved, has actually come above the ground in certain areas. And so we call those outcrops. And we can go to those outcrops and get a sense of what the rock could possibly look like deep, deep, deep underneath us.
Oh, okay.
And then finally, because we are a lot more progressed in our oil and gas development, we can actually look at analog wells that have already been drilled into similar formations, and we can create maps between them of what we think is happening underground. This is what geologists do. Is they have one well here, we have one well here, we can make some extrapolations and guesses of what's in between.
Okay. Interesting.
All right. So now I've got a question I'm super interested in. Have you guys ever guessed wrong. And have you ever thought there was something there and there wasn't, or vice versa?
Definitely. Definitely. Okay. And that is part of the learning process. It's a sad part of the learning process, but it has happened because these wells are usually not very cheap.
That's what I was going to say. That's a big expensive mistake, isn't it?
Yeah. So we actually as engineers have to do a lot of business calculations to decide before we even drill a well, whether we think that we are going to produce enough to pay back the amount of money that we spent to get there in the first place. So we're making projections and we're also trying to guess how is it going to produce over the next 50 years? Not just today, over the next 50 years. Yeah. And what is that going to look like? So there have been times where we have drilled a well and it's not that the oil or gas wasn't there. It's that it wasn't enough.
To pay back.
So
the reservoir wasn't big enough.
So it didn't produce to the extent that we hoped for. And so it isn't a failure in the sense that we didn't find something. It's that it's just not enough for us to keep going, or maybe we're not quite in the right spot. But the good thing about drilling a well is now we're here. We're underground and we can actually get some real data. Instead of all the guesses we're making up at the surface where we don't really know what's going on, we can start doing experiments in this well to start taking rocks and looking at them and looking at what percent of water, what percent of oil was in here. What does the pressure look like? Is it enough to produce in the long term? And then we can start rehypothesizing where maybe a better well could be. Or maybe it tells us, this isn't the right spot for us and we need to go somewhere else.
So is that what you do as a chemical engineer, is you do a lot of experiments kind of with this? Do you actually help make the guesses, or is that more of a geologist thing?
So the geologists and the geophysicists are the ones that kind of situate where they think it's going to exist. But the engineers are the ones that are actually going to come up with those guesses. They're going to work to simulate how the oil and gas would flow, what it would look like under the surface, and specifically reservoir engineers is what we call them, will come up with these guesses on how they think the well will produce over time. And then we use those numbers in conjunction with numbers from various disciplines on how much they think it'll cost for us to get there, how much they think it'll cost for us to transport it. And we put all those numbers together, how much it'll cost for us to reclaim the land when we're all done. And we look at the big picture and say, okay, we think we're going to make some money here. We'll go ahead and drill this well.
This sounds like a job that involves so many more things than so many more pieces of the puzzle to put together. I'm struggling on how to say it, but you're not just doing one little job of, okay, I show up at my desk, I do these calculations, and that's the job. You are putting together a complete puzzle with pieces from all different aspects, the chemical, the geological, and all of the business aspects to decide whether or not you're actually going to do your job.
Definitely. And I think that's the most exciting part of it. I think it's such a, it's a job that involves so many different people. And so we're getting into a room and we're collaborating and we're trying to fit those pieces of the puzzle together and decide as a team what we think the best thing to do next is.
All I'm thinking is, this is where you use the math, kids. Right here.
Yeah.
This job. Everyone says, where am I going to need the math? Right here. This is where you need it. Right.
And it's fun
math.
In a
whole bunch of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely.
How many different aspects of our lives, because we're talking about math and how we're actually going to use it, how many different aspects of our lives do oil and gas touch?
A lot. A lot. I think it's hard to come up with one thing that it hasn't touched in one way. I'll go so far as to say, because oil and gas isn't just the gas in our cars. Mm-hmm. It's actually in a lot of our household and daily products, and we just don't realize it. So I'll give you a couple of examples that when I first heard, I was like, whoa, lipstick, deodorant, MRI machines, the asphalt and the roads that our cars drive on. It's used in making solar panels and windmills. It's used to make your iPhone and your laptop. Basically, it's used in a lot of plastic products, and it's also heavily used in the manufacturing of steel and concrete, which is actually used in a lot of products that we use today as well. So whether it's part of the manufacturing process or in the actual product itself, or just in the car of the delivery guy who's coming to your house to get it to you, one way or another, oil and gas is probably touching the product that you're using.
I mean, that's crazy how much it is. So I want to go back to when you talked a little bit about when you tap the oil reserve. Does the oil just come up the tube, or do you actually have to pump it out? Because I've always wondered that.
We do. We have to pump it. A lot of the time we do have to pump it at the surface for oil. Depending on the reservoir, some reservoirs will flow easier than others. So that's another thing that we're doing before we plan to drill the well, is we're evaluating that cost of it as well.
Does the gas just come up, or does it actually have to be pumped too?
No, the gas will just come up. We may need compression, though. We might need compressors at the surface and things like that. But yeah, again, these are all things that are numbers that we're looking at prior to drilling the well, so that we understand at the surface what we need to be able to produce it properly.
I think that part of the engineering is cool. I think humans have the best way of solving problems, because you know the gas is coming up, but you have to capture it right away. Otherwise your money is floating away, right? kind of thing. And I just think that's really cool. So then you create pipes and compressors and whatever to move the gas around and the oil around as you need it. I think that's really cool.
It is. It's very neat. And there's so many different parts of it, and every single part is important. So whether it's us that are finding it, then when we get to the surface, we need the network to be able to move it around, because like I said, it's not everywhere. So on the other side of the country or wherever you may be, you may not have oil and gas right under your feet. And so you need someone to bring it to you so that you can have electricity and gas for your cars. And yeah, we need those refineries to be able to turn it into gas. So everyone has a part to play to get it to all of us so that we can have lights on and cars to go.
And your phones work.
And our computers work so we can do this podcast.
That's right.
Jennifer, that was a really cool question you asked, because all I could go to was a States of Matter lesson. When you're drilling for gas, the gas will come up.
Yep.
But if it's oil in its liquid state, then it's not just going to come up without the pressure that you mentioned before, Maria. That leads me to wonder, have you ever drilled in one area and found one instead of the other? Like, you thought it was going to be oil, but it was actually natural gas?
No, I don't think so, but it's a really good question. So the reason that I don't think that that has happened is because a lot of the times we kind of find both together. So if there's enough space in the reservoir, some of the gas might get dissolved in the oil and then come out of it on top of it. And we call that a gas cap. So there's a gas layer and there's an oil layer. So we're drilling the well and we're trying to get into the oil. I mean, there could be a situation where you drilled the well and it was a bit too shallow and then you only got gas. So that's a good point. But oftentimes there is some gas actually dissolved in the oil. That's something that we need to separate when we get to the surface.
I mean, that's just so cool. Now, I mean, I was a chemistry major when I went to college. So I know that there's many different directions, right? You come out as a chemistry major and you can go to do labs, you can do this. So how did you as a chemical engineer decide on oil and gas? I mean, because there's so many things you could do with chemical engineering.
Absolutely. There are so many things, like I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, there are so many different processes that we can be involved in. And so for me, because I'm in Alberta, this is a huge industry for us. Mm-hmm. And so I did an internship when I was doing my degree, which is basically you get to work with a company while you're still in school. And I did that for a little over a year, and it was with an oil and gas company, and I actually really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. So I decided to go back to it. And I also had my dad, who was an engineer in this industry. And so sometimes they say engineering's genetic.
Which is not a bad thing.
No, it isn't. So I decided to try oil and gas out, and it stuck. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the creativity and the problem solving and the science and the math all coming together.
That's terrific. That is a great lesson for our listeners on, you know, you went into chemical engineering, and even Jennifer was studying chemistry. And you just never know where the starting line is going to take you along the journey.
Definitely, definitely. And it lends itself to so many more industries. I've had friends who have gone back to do environmental engineering, or you end up completely switching into a different industry completely. But the things that you learn in school, they're just tools on problem solving. And how to learn and think in a critical way so that you can apply those skills and learn on the job how to solve the problems that you need to for that industry.
That's awesome. And that's the purpose of this podcast. So on the podcast, we like to ask all of our experts, do you have a challenge for the kids that kind of relates to what we were talking about here?
Mm-hmm. So my challenge, which I kind of alluded to already, was I had an infographic, which I shared with Jen and Jeff, and hopefully will be on the website. And mm-hmm. My challenge is to find 5 ordinary everyday things in your house that oil and gas help make. And if you want to take it even further, if you want an extra challenge, find 3 random things and think about how oil and gas was a part of either making it or is a part of the actual product or a part of bringing it to you.
I love that.
That is a very cool challenge. And I will say, both for you, Maria, and for all of our listeners, I looked at that infographic, which will be on our website page. I couldn't find the answer. So as we sit here right now doing the podcast, Jeff still does not know the correct answer. But I don't want you to tell me, because I want to spend some more time trying to figure it out.
Well, I think it's a cool challenge, because I think you'll see things that you didn't realize were made with oil and gas. You know, you kind of look them up and you're like, oh, there it is. And the ingredients, or you can mm-hmm. Google it or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that's a fantastic challenge. And I'm hoping that some kids will do that and then perhaps share it with us on our social media. We are at KidSolve. You can tag us on Instagram or Twitter. And we'd love to see what you guys come up with that. But this has been a fabulous conversation. Thank you so much for joining us, Maria. I have learned so much about chemical engineering and oil and gas.
Oh, awesome. I was so happy to be here.
Agreed. However, before we let you go, you hinted at something just before we started recording. Are you starting on a new project that might touch our listeners as well?
Yes, I actually am. So right now I'm actually taking a pause for my engineering job, and I am writing some children's books, which with a large STEM focus. So yes. Look out for those books from Maria Marie and Igam, hopefully coming out in the near future.
That will be awesome. We always love great STEM authors to help kids about that.
And I know there's going to be some problem solving in those books.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks so much for being on Solve It for Kids, Maria.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for letting us into your world. This was exciting.
Thank you.
Wasn't that a fantastic interview with Maria Marianayagam? I can't wait to spend some more time looking at that infographic, because I've already looked at it once and I still don't know which single product on there wasn't touched by the oil and gas industry. What about you, Jennifer?
I mean, it was just so amazing. You never think about all of these products that you have in your house
that come from oil and gas. It's just kind of mind-boggling. I hope all of you kids take up the challenge. Be sure to go to our website, solveitforkids.com, because it gives you, you get to see the cool infographic that Jeff was just talking about. And you get all of the instructions for how to do it. But the other thing that I keep forgetting to mention, go to our solveitforkids.com website because we offer a book giveaway for every episode. All you have to do is leave a comment. Right. All you have to do is leave a comment there or tag us on our social media on Instagram or Twitter. We are at KidSolve and leave us a comment there. And you could be entered to win a kid's book. And you could go back for all of the episodes and do the same thing. So check us out there at solveitforkids.com. But now we are so excited because we, Jeff and I, get to meet again next week for another episode of Solve It for Kids!